Unencumbered by political correctness, undeterred in her mission to spread the truth, unafraid to be a true conservative, she's unapologetic, uncompromising, unwavering, and an undeniably powerful voice when we need it most. This is Rose Unplugged.
This episode of Rose Unplugged is brought to you by MyPillow and Mike Lindau. Now, they want to thank everybody for all of your support. And to thank you, since they have an overstock, they're doing a clearance and new product sale right now for the best prices ever when you use promo code ROSE. You get free shipping. It doesn't even matter how large the item is. Free shipping on your entire order. 50% off of the MyPillow, 50% off brand new flannel sheets, six-pack towel sets, only $29.98. You know what? There's just so much on. You just have to go there and look at it yourself. I love their dog beds, and so does my dog, Tucker. So to get the best specials ever, go to MyPillow.com and use the promo code ROSE. Free shipping on the entire order. MyPillow.com, promo code ROSE. And I really do appreciate your support. It helps me keep this podcast going. Joining me today on this episode of Rose Unplugged is someone I've had on before. I love talking to him, particularly about China, and that is Bradley Thayer. He is a founding member of the Committee on Present Danger China and a former visiting fellow at Magdalen College, University of Oxford. He is joined today by James Fennell. He is a retired U.S. Navy captain serving 29 years in the military. He's a former director of intelligence and information operations for the U.S. Pacific Fleet, government fellow at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, and founding member of the Committee on Present Danger China. Today, we're going to talk about your book, Embracing Communist China, America's Greatest Strategic Failure. Thank you both for being with me today.
It's our pleasure, Rose. Thank you for having us on.
Thank you. You know,
great to be here.
Thank you, James. You know, for a long time now, we've been talking about how poor leadership leads to the situation we find ourselves on the global stage, but particularly with China. But in this book, you talk about this going on for decades, how we've underestimated the threat from China. Can you explain to me how we've done that and how long this has actually been going on?
The origins of this go back to when the United States foreign policy shifted recognition from the Republic of China in Taiwan to the People's Republic of China on the mainland of China. And we developed what we later call, and it's been developed, the engagement school, where our elites in the U.S. government, academics, and other areas began to develop these links to the People's Republic of China through our business community and other areas, where we're placing a priority on engaging because we wanted the Chinese to help us offset the Soviet threat during the Cold War. This was built on and expanded upon because of Deng Xiaoping, who was leading China at that time, and he was fully understood kind of some of the greed and avarice that our nation had, and was willing to seek making money in China over being concerned about national defense because China was so weak back then. And after 40 years of successive administrations, Republican and Democrat, that continued to engage and place engagement as a priority, it became ingrained in our thinking and the way we operate. And so we have a system where everybody is saying it's to our advantage to engage with China because we'll see them moderate themselves and adopt international norms, and it will reduce tensions in the region, and we can all just get on with global trade, and everybody's boats will rise. You know, the old naval saying, a rising tide lifts all boats. So that's what we believed for 40 years, and we practiced it. And it became so ingrained, but no one ever stopped and said, well, is this working or not? And is things actually getting better? Are they becoming normalized into the international order? Or are they starting their own international order? And it wasn't until the Trump administration that you actually had people come in and ask those hard questions. And that's when we went from labeling them as an engagement partner to a strategic competitor. And that was really a seminal change in U.S. foreign policy with the PRC in that administration. Our concern is that what we're seeing now in this last year is a return to the engagement school with all the leaders that last year that started going to Beijing, Secretary of State Blinken, CIA Director Secretary Yellen, Secretary Raimondo, Climate Czar Kerry, Henry Kissinger one last time, all went back there to set up this big meeting that happened in San Francisco in November last year, where Biden and Xi met, and basically said, we're resuming engagement. And we're now starting to see that much more.
Yes.
And this is really worrisome because we know that it didn't work.
You know, it is worrisome. And I'd like to talk to you for a moment, Bradley, because when James was talking about that shift, and particularly the shift that happened during the Trump administration, it was almost too late. And in fact, even though it was a good idea, now we've got a new administration that does not still see that as a good idea. What are we going to do going forward? And have we embraced communist China to the extent that really there is no turning around?
Well, we have embraced it, certainly, to our essentially misfortune. The first rule of strategy is do not help your adversary. Mm-hmm. And of course, we've been helping our enemy, as Jim said, now for over 40 years with the support we've given to communist China, again, with the exception of the Trump administration. But it's not too late. We've got ourselves definitely in a difficult situation, and we need to focus on getting out of it. That's going to require new leadership. We're not going to get that from the Biden administration. Obviously, as Jim mentioned, the meeting in San Francisco really was the acme or the epitome of the engagement school under Joe Biden, where 400 business leaders came together to give communist dictator Xi Jinping a standing ovation twice, not just once. Once wasn't good enough, but twice. And so that's appalling. But new leadership can turn this around, as we had Trump with focusing on really cutting off the Chinese Communist Party's financial support that they're getting from New York financiers and Wall Street, as well as taking military measures and diplomatic measures against the People's Republic of China.
So, Jim, when we talk about this,
okay.
We're talking, and my concern is that in the meantime, until we have another administration, someone who understands the situation in China, and God help us, I hope we do. But if we don't, you can already see that the effects of all of this. And China has become emboldened. When you look at the relationship that China has formed or is forming with Russia, even Iran, there's something to be concerned about there, isn't it? And you've got your military experience to kind of read the leaves here, if you will. But are you not concerned about these unholy alliances that we can see forming right now?
Well, they're not just forming right now in terms of Russia and China. They go back to 2005 at the creation of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
Oh.
And it was a combination of basically Russia and China and some of these stands, if you will, the smaller nations around Russia. And when they first started doing military exercises 20 years ago, the Russians would laugh at the Chinese. And now the Russians are, you know, not laughing anymore, and they're working with them. And just in this last year, we've had Chinese and Russian naval surface action groups work together, 10 ships transiting around Japan, circumnavigating Japan. So we hear a lot about Chinese Navy ships and carriers going around Taiwan. But a lot of folks in America don't know that the Chinese and Russians are threatening Japan with that way, in the same way. Chinese and Russian naval or air forces, they're flying bombers and fighters into each other's country. This last year, Chinese bombers and fighters flew from China through the around the southern tip of South Korea and into the Sea of Japan and then landed in the Far East in Russia. Likewise, Russian bombers and fighters went the other way and landed in China. So they're working together very closely. And then we know that China has, you know, relations with obviously a huge influence over North Korea, and North Korea selling artillery and other things to Russia to help them in the war in the Ukraine. And then there's obvious connections with China and Russia into Iran, and they're even doing naval exercises together. They've done a series of naval exercises. So, yes, there is, as President Bush called it a long time ago, there is an axis of evil that's very active and much more developed than people give it credit for.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, it's interesting, too. Right now, what's going on is we read a lot about China warning the EU and the UK of a negative impact because finally, you know, there's been some blacklisting of some of the firms when you spoke about aiding Russia's war against Ukraine. They're responding to that. They also, Bradley, are talking about their plans to crush Elon Musk and Tesla. And plus, you know, we've helped them in the EV industry, by the way. It's just amazing to me just how far we are from doing anything quite right where China is concerned. But when we think about all of these things and how they have this ability, you know, where chips are concerned and the control that they can ultimately have, I think, over many nations, are you afraid, Bradley?
Well, there's reason for great concern about this, but we also need to recognize they've got clay feet. So they're a formidable adversary, but they're fundamentally, because they're a communist regime, they're illegitimate, and they have no popular mandate for ruling. And so the CCP is inherently precarious. China's going into an economic downturn, and despite the success that they've had economically in the past with EVs, obviously batteries, Rose, as you mentioned, and to some degree in chips and in other mechanisms, that's based on our technology.
Yes.
And that's based really on our finance, right? Mm-hmm. We're subsidizing the Chinese Communist Party of China. And the way to solve the problem that we have with this dangerous regime is to cut their finance off. Cut them off from technology, cut them off from trade, and capitalize on the resentment and the anger that the Chinese people have towards the Chinese Communist Party, in conjunction with the Chinese diaspora worldwide, and people of goodwill around the world who would like to see this evil regime ejected from power. And so there's reason for great concern, and we shouldn't ever lower our guard, as indeed we have, which is the point of the book for the last 40 years almost, right? That this engagement school was absolutely the wrong framework to adopt. We abandoned power politics, which served us so well during World War II and the Cold War, in favor of the idea that if we work with the Chinese Communist Party, they'll get rich. And if they get rich, they'll be peaceful, and they'll adopt essentially Western norms and values and democracy. That was a disaster. So the way we need to do it is recognize they're an enemy, recognize we should not fund them or engage with them in any capacity, and then marshal our efforts to evict them from power.
Do you expect this to be done? I mean, listen, guys, we're talking about this with the hope that there's going to be administration change, and with that, a better understanding of the threat that China holds over us, or could potentially over the entire globe, if you ask me. So we're hoping in a new administration. What happens if we don't get that?
Well, it's a cause of great concern. It's unlikely that Biden will make it, obviously.
Right.
If he does and is reelected, well, then we would expect the continuation of this disastrous policy. We would also expect it under Gavin Newsom,
yes,
who's quite closely tied to Xi Jinping and really soiled himself in front of Xi Jinping in November in San Francisco. Michelle Obama, if she is the Democrat candidate and becomes president, we would expect something really along those lines. So Rose, breaking, if you will, the headlock that engagement has is exactly right. We need to have the right leadership, and it's unlikely that we're going to get it from Biden or Newsom, or quite likely from Michelle Obama. So the election of 2024 is important for so many reasons, and not the least of which because of this is the opportunity, really, to have the return of President Trump, and with his clear-sighted recognition that the Chinese Communist Party is our enemy, and we need to, again, focus our efforts on them. So much depends on November 5th, 2024.
We're talking to James Fennell and Bradley Thayer on their book, Embracing Communist China, America's Greatest Strategic Failure. You know, Jim, we're talking about all of that, and Bradley mentioned Gavin Newsom, and that entire scene. It was the weirdest thing that I ever saw play out in my life, inviting the Chinese leader to California, but of all places, San Francisco, and then watching the cleanup happen. It's like we're living in an imaginary world sometimes. I feel like, you know, we were pretending like what's going on in San Francisco isn't going on in San Francisco when all the world knows what's going on in San Francisco. I thought that was strange to begin with. But what is this relationship that Bradley mentioned between Newsom and China? Why is there a relationship there in the first place?
Well, it's about money. And so, you know, there's been exposure. California has one of the largest state employee retirement funds and investment funds and billions of dollars. And that was being invested in China. So the California, you know, it's a one-party state. And Newsom's running it. And so he's been very close with them and this kind of investments that California has with their employee money. And remember, before the event in November, earlier in the year in October, just a month before, Newsom had gone to Beijing and kowtowed before Xi. So, this was a setup. They had sent Newsom to Beijing to meet with Xi and basically arrange for what was going to happen in November in San Francisco. So this is a very, you know, the depths of the engagement school that are back in power now. It's like the Trump administration didn't even exist. And so I think, as Brad said, the election in November is really critical, but we don't have time to wait until then. The head of the Pacific Fleet, who's going to take over as the commander of the Indo-Pacific Command, Admiral Sam Papro, quoted in Newsweek as saying, hey, you know, right now the Chinese military has the capability to essentially do a large-scale exercise in and around Taiwan and then launch into an invasion or some kind of blockade or something like that. They have the capacity to do that right now. So it's important that we are talking about these issues on your show and other shows to make sure that people are not going to accept this and put pressure on this administration to do the things that Brad mentioned. And for instance, we just saw National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan go on and was asked about why the administration added another 500 Russian companies to a sanctions list. And he said, well, it's really important because we need to choke off Russia's ability to have money so that they can't buy and build more weapon systems. So intellectually, they understand that providing money to governments that are adversaries is not a good thing. But they won't admit that ever for the PRC. And we need to call out that hypocrisy, expose their inconsistent and illogical policy prescriptions, and say, hey, we need to do the same thing to China. Because when the Chinese invade Taiwan, it's not just going to affect the people of Taiwan. There are going to be sailors on the U.S. 7 fleet, in the U.S. 7 fleet, on our ships that are going to die. There are going to be airmen and Marines that are ashore in bases in Japan that are going to be struck. We have knowledge. We have commercial imagery that shows Chinese ballistic missile training in central China where they're testing the warheads. And those where they're practicing launching these ballistic missiles at mock-up facilities of U.S. Navy facilities in Yokosuka, Japan. And so this is not something that's, you know, we're fighting for a bunch of foreign rocks. This is about American lives and our interest in Asia to keep, you know, our trade going and to keep people in America clothed and fed. So this is a really dangerous thing. And a lot of people that are, you know, wearing the uniform at the four-star level have been warning over the last year and a half that things are getting really tense right now. And that it's almost at a critical state. So even waiting until November may not be good enough.
Yeah.
We need to raise this issue now.
You know, thank you. I mean, you make an excellent point about that. And I know that, Bradley, you and I have been talking for years about how Beijing has been pushing the envelope where Taiwan is concerned. And if something like this should happen, if they continue to feel emboldened enough to move forward on their plans for Taiwan, Bradley, that could just be the beginning of something. I mean, because we have to respond, right? Although I'm not sure we actually would under this administration. What are your thoughts on that, Bradley?
Well, there is ambiguity, sadly. The Biden administration has not had a consistent and clear message to Beijing regarding deterrence and our commitment to Taiwan. So Xi Jinping, the communist dictator, has been clear that he's going to conquer Taiwan. He's going to bring it under the control of the Chinese Communist Party. And we've had many admirals and generals, including Air Force General Mike Minahan, warned last year, about a year ago, in a leaked memorandum that he anticipated Beijing would move against Taiwan next year in 2025. And as I said, a series of admirals have echoed that. U.S. Naval admirals have echoed that, too. So things are moving in that direction and may certainly be sooner than 2025. We could anticipate action this year against Taiwan. Therefore, it is absolutely critical to ensure that we can deter an attack, because deterrence is far more valuable. We want to avoid this conflict, and the way to avoid it is to have strength as well as clarity of message and a determination conveyed to Beijing that we will not tolerate this. And so it's very important that your audience recognize that point and understand why Taiwan is important. For economic reasons, it's important because our chips, our economy is heavily dependent on the chips made in Taiwan.
Yes.
And so is the Western economy. Secondly, Taiwan's important because it has key bases, U.S. Bases for the U.S. military and intelligence community. Thirdly, it's important as a political symbol, because Taiwan shows what China might have been. It shows that the Chinese people can have a democracy. They can have, as they just had their elections on January in Taiwan on January 13th,
yes.
If you recall, right? Taiwan shows that the Chinese Communist Party is illegitimate, and the Chinese people can live under a democratic government and can prosper under a democratic government. So for all of those reasons, Xi Jinping wants to hurt the Western economy. He wants to deny the U.S. Access to critical bases. And he wants to finally destroy, really, an alternative vision of China, that, and a far better one, that Taiwan represents. So Taiwan is critical to Americans for all of those reasons. And thus, we need to move with dispatch, that's immediately, to ensure we do the utmost to deter an attack against Taiwan.
You know, Taiwan, now I'm thinking about it, has provided a thorn in the side of China because of those reasons, particularly because it actually shows that you can live independently, just as you said. You know, and when you think about the chips, too, you know, just recently we had there was an issue with cell phones in a couple of states here in this country, and it just brought everything to a halt, you know, for a good part of the day when that happened. But it just shows you the importance of, I mean, how much we rely on our iPhones, our, you know, all of that technology that could be at risk right now that Bradley talked about. And James, I'll throw this question to you, because there was just recently satellite images that showed this floating barrier in that South China Sea area that's heavily disputed. China feels that it's their area, and it's never, they dispute the claim that it is not their area. What are your thoughts on that as a military guy?
Right. Well, the South China Sea has been an object of China's the Communist Party's, you know, it's been in one of the things that they use as a propaganda tool back at home in China to tell people that that is, you know, always been part of China and China's territory in historic terms, which is a false statement, but they use that. And so what really happened, there was a skirmish in that Mischief Reef where the PRC was able to, you know, move in and take on control over a small little reefed area of the PRC or the Philippines. But the big event happened in 2012 at Scarborough Shoal, which is a shoal that's about 140 miles off of the coast of Manila, about 140 miles inside their exclusive economic zone. And in 2012, Chinese commercial vessels were inside the shoal stealing giant clams and coral to sell back in mainland China. And the Filipinos found out about it, and they kind of exposed it to the world when they sent one of their warships there that didn't really, wasn't threatening anybody, just wanted to see what was happening inside their EEZ. and they put it on television. And the next week, China sent about 11 ships down and surrounded it and basically took it away from China. And that was all facilitated by the Obama administration when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. And her head of the Asia Department for the State Department was a guy named Kirk Campbell, who's now the Deputy Secretary of State. Great. And they basically sold out the Republic of the Philippines, our treaty ally. We have five treaty allies in the Pacific, and the Philippines is one of them. We have a mutual defense treaty with the Philippines, and we essentially let our ally down. And when that happened in 2012 and China took possession of Scarborough Shoal, it sent a signal across the region to our allies that maybe America's not cannot be relied upon. Mm-hmm. And so here we are now 12 years later, and these things are still happening. China is still pushing and threatening and bullying the smaller nations in the South China Sea. And remember also, from 2013 to 2015, China built seven artificial islands in the southern part of the South China Sea, in the Spratly Islands. And three of those islands are the size of Pearl Harbor. Wow. And I guarantee you, nobody in your audience ever heard that China built three Pearl Harbors in the South China Sea. And then you can recall also that Xi went to Washington and met with Obama and promised that he would not militarize those islands. Yet today, those islands are staging bases for bombers, yes. PLA bombers and fighters and naval warships. So they've transformed the South China Sea, and right now they've got a huge amount of pressure that they're putting on the Republic of the Philippines because they have a new president, Aquino, and Aquino is now taking a much more return to the more traditional view of U.S.-Philippine alliance and seeking our protection, and Beijing's not happy about that because they had a kind of a dupe in the previous president, Duterte. And so now what we're seeing is a full effort again by the PRC to pressurize the Filipinos into taking and keeping them from having any access to Scarborough Shoal. There's another shoal called Second Thomas Shoal, which is farther south up of Palawan. And there's other areas where the Chinese are just ramping up the pressure to essentially force the Philippines to accept Chinese rule. So this is a part of the overall, what the Chinese call, the great rejuvenation of China. And they want to be able to restore all the things that they say is theirs. And the South China Sea is one. Taiwan is one. The southern Japanese islands are the Ryukyus and the Senkaku Islands is another area. There's disputed borders with India. And there's even disputed borders with Mongolia. And we believe that, China, before they can have this great rejuvenation in 2049 of the restoration of all of China, which is the goal that Xi is, and the party has stated that they publicly will do, the 100th anniversary of the People's Republic of China, they have to restore all that territory to under their control. They were able to get Hong Kong here in the last few years without firing a shot, and 7 million people went from being somewhat free and autonomous to now being completely under the thumb of Beijing. In fact, many citizens in Hong Kong were taken out of the city and sent into the concentration camps in Western China. So they want to control and say that they own these things, and they've tried to get control by not using force. But they're at the point now where if they can't get it through non-kinetic means, through economic information and political power, they will use military power.
Well, yeah, two things on that. I mean, first of all, I just want to mention that there does appear to be, according to these new satellite images, in the Scarborough Shoal, a new floating barrier. So it's like they're kind of flexing their muscles again. There's a new one. But when you talk about not using force, how then were they able to take that control when we talk about those islands and so forth? How did they?
Well, in Scarborough Shoal, I was a director of intelligence for the U.S. Pacific Fleet when this happened. And so I was there and was involved with it. And what happened was that, again, it's a traditional fishing ground for the Filipino fishermen on their what they call bonka boats. So they're not mass commercial fishermen. They're, just getting subsistence fishing for their families and their villages. And they were that's where they normally fished. And then they found this Chinese commercial vessels that were there in April of 2012, and they saw them in the shoal. They had boats that would go pull this coral reefs and giant clams out, and they put them on these bigger commercial vessels. And the Filipinos, as it sent out one of their warships to go see what was happening, and they went on board these commercial vessels and videotaped what they saw. And they put that in their evening news. And the Chinese got so upset that they sent all these ships out there, and they surrounded the shoal. And then what happened was is that Pert Campbell said, well, let's get the Filipinos together with the Chinese, Madam Fu Ying, who's senior foreign ministry person from the PRC. And they negotiated from April through June. And they had an agreement, Kurt Campbell says. They thought we had an agreement that on this day, June 15, 2012, both nations would leave Scarborough Shoal and then we'd resolve the situation diplomatically. And that day came, and the Filipinos kept their word, and they pulled their ships out, and the Chinese did not. And that's how they kept control of Scarborough Shoal. And in between, that was 12 years ago, they've had erected a barrier in front of the shoal on and off over the years. And what's happened here in the last 2 months or 3 months is that the Chinese built this barrier, but the Filipinos under Aquino sent out their Navy SEALs equivalent and underwater divers, and they cut it. And then the Chinese have rebuilt it. So there is a small level conflict going on at Scarborough Shoal again.
Thank you for explaining that to me. Bradley, when we talked earlier, and we do mention that China really economically isn't doing so great, but at the same time, they've got a huge military, so many men that are a part of that military, and they are strategic in so many ways. I think that they can be successful in a lot of endeavors in an effort to kind of gain control over more and more areas of the globe. Am I right?
Well, empirically, that's true. As we were just discussing, they're making the South China Sea really their sovereign territory in a de facto sense.
But beyond,
we're not doing anything.
But beyond,
while they're pushing, and they're pushing India, indeed.
Right.
So it's all azimuth. It's aggression in all azimuths, and that's very dangerous, of course. So they do have prodigious military capabilities, which they're employing to advance the interests of the Chinese Communist Party, and against directly opposed to the interests of the United States and our allies in the Indo-Pacific and globally. So, again, they're increasingly using the military instrument to advance their policies, and that does not augur well, right? That suggests there's going to come a time soon where there's going to be a clash between China and one of our allies, like the Philippines, one of our partners, like Taiwan, or the United States itself. And it's particularly worrisome because under Xi Jinping, here's an individual who's hyper-aggressive and is determined to realize these objectives today, right? He doesn't want to wait until 2049,
right,
the centenary of the revolution, but he wants it today.
I agree.
So a very dangerous situation.
Yeah, and I'm not certain that we will be there in every way we need to for the Philippines and Taiwan. And I think, James, that's what scares me in the end.
Yeah, and that's China, what happened in 2012 with Scarborough, this Chinese started writing about the Scarborough model, which is to say, if they can continue to pressurize and acquire things without firing a shot, it kind of snowballs and it does a domino effect in reverse, you know, against us for them, whereby it shows that America's weak and won't stand up for their allies, which means other nations will then be less likely to resist. And you were mentioning before about worldwide activity. I would just say, you know, in 2019, I was in Kiel, Germany for Kiel Week, which is an annual naval event that goes on up there. And the Chinese pulled in a ship, a frigate that had been on patrol in the Gulf of Aden for 3.5 months. So it left China, went to the Gulf of Aden, operated doing escorting of commercial vessels through the Gulf of Aden and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait into the Red Sea for 3.5 months. And then it went through the Suez Canal, through the Mediterranean, up to the Baltic. And I got on that ship. There was a reception. and they didn't know that I was coming on board. And I was on for 3.5 hours, and I saw this ship, and I saw the sailors and the staffs that were on embarked, and they're very capable. They are a growing naval power, and just in this last couple of months, they had their 43rd Naval Escort Task Force that had finished its operations in the Gulf of Aden, went through the Mediterranean, then went into the Atlantic, and then went down to the west coast of Africa in the Gulf of Guinea, and they pulled into every nation there, four or five nations, for five-day port calls. And now there's a lot of talk, and we heard reporting and leaked reporting from this administration that one of the nations down there had promised G that they would allow them to create and make a naval base. So we're expecting the Chinese will have a naval base in the next year or two in the Atlantic. Uh-huh. So this should get people's attention.
Oh, you've got mine.
As well as in Cuba. Cuba too, Rose.
Wow.
Yeah, the Soviet/Russian bases too, the Chinese are using there. So in the Caribbean and in South and Central America too, the presence is ever increasing.
Yeah, we're really in trouble if we don't get this together. Guys, I know I kept you longer than I said, but I'm sorry. You know, Bradley, that I love talking about this subject because it is so important. And I think I happen to be someone who believes that this is not only historical, but biblical, what's happening right now. And so I'm watching with great interest how this all plays out. Bradley, if you'd like to just give us your final thoughts, representing both yourself and James. And I want to mention the book again. It's Embracing Communist China, America's Greatest Strategic Failure. We've got James Fennell and Bradley Thayer, who are the authors. There's a great foreword in there by Steve Bannon. But Bradley, why don't you just close us out here with your final thoughts?
Well, sure. Thank you, Rose. And thank you for the opportunity to reach your audience. What we do is call attention to what every American should know, which is, how did this happen? How is it that the U.S. supported the rise of the Chinese Communist Party from, in essence, 1990 until today? The consequences of that, of course, are profound. And we offer some solutions, too, about what can be done really to alert Americans to the enemy that we face in the CCP. But we need to take heart because we are Americans. We faced great threats before. And what we need to do is marshal ourselves and our strength to recognize much of our elite is compromised, our media, universities, financial centers. But if we're able to unite around a leader, if we're able to unite around the recognition of this threat, Jim and I are fully confident, of course, that Americans are going to be able to act as they have before to defeat tyranny in the 20th century. We were very successful in that, and we'll be able to do it again in the 21st century if we're aware of the nature of the enemy all of the tools that he employs against us. So, Rose, thank you very much indeed for the opportunity to reach your audience.
Well, thank you both, too. James, thank you so much for your service to this country, and you continue to serve by being a part of this great book, Embracing Communist China. I'm assuming you can get this anywhere books are sold. Am I correct, guys?
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. Okay, thank you both, and God bless you both, too, and thank you for the work that you do. I know that you've been trying to get the word out for a very long time, and I just pray that it is loud and clear, and those who need to hear it will hear it. Thank you both for what you do.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you.
All right, take care.